Hello, and welcome to Sip, Sip, Hooray, the podcast for people thirsty for great stories about wine and the people who make it. On today's show, a guest who is passionate about a sense of place, both in terms of where his grapes are grown and his own origin story. Rob Bergstrom, owner and winemaker of Sander & Hem, has Norwegian roots, but his wine focus thus far is firmly planted in the Santa Cruz Mountains. Rob's background in science helps inform what he does with wine grapes. We're excited to get to know Rob and Sander & Hem better today. We are the two Marys who like to eat, drink, and be merry. I'm Mary Babbitt.
And I'm Mary Orland. And wine history have always been intertwined for Sander & Hem's Rob Bergstrom. Every bottle here tells a story about the place it's grown, as well as being a lens on the wines and the winemakers of past eras. He is very passionate about the history of the Santa Cruz Mountains Appalachian wine-growing region, but he's also focused on moving the story forward, bringing forgotten, lost vineyards to the forefront, and pushing the Appalachian to beyond the limits of what's possible in the bottle and in your glass. So, Rob, welcome to Sip, Sip, Hooray.
Hi, thank you for having me today. Glad to be here.
We are excited to get to know you. And I think the best place to start with is a little bit of background. So I mentioned you have a science background. Tell us about that.
I do. I initially came to the Bay Area to do a postdoc in biomedical research at UCSF. I had a pretty linear pathway through biochemistry, biophysics, and came out here to do research in breast cancer research. And then soon after, I pivoted many times. You come to Silicon Valley and you find yourself changing gears again and again. So I did a postdoc. I started looking at professorship opportunities. And then I fell down the rabbit hole of management consulting. And I found myself traveling the world as a management consultant, working for healthcare, pharma, and then alternative energy. Came home to have some children. a really big thing in my life, my three kids and my wife. And ended up doing a series of startups, including a foods company, which was in Vietnam. And, you know, there's a lot of touch points on how I came to wine, but many stepping stones, you know, all pathways seem to come back to wine. And so here I am. We launched Sander & Hem in 2018.
When you say all pathways came back to wine, was it something that you were always interested in? Had you grown up drinking wine?
Good question. So, you know, it's like a lot of little rivulets becoming a river. My father was a UC Davis chemistry professor. So you can imagine on the weekends as a kid, I was running around the barns of Napa in the 70s. My mother came from China and the family had a Chinese restaurant. So I grew up really celebrating food. And that was my connection to my Asian relatives. And therefore, we were always thinking about food and celebrating food and being thoughtful about food was very important, food and beverage. My parents love wine, so it was something that was at the dinner table. And then fast forward through my graduate career, I started being interested in wine. I joined a tasting group. I was drinking wines not from the Santa Cruz Mountains, but from Napa, Sonoma, maybe a little bit of Burgundy here and there. And then when I ended up coming to the Bay Area, all of a sudden I discovered this amazing food and wine scene. It was just explosive. Right away, I remember when I came out here for an interview, they poured me Ridge wines. I was floored. I was like, wow. And they were telling me this is from the backyard here. It's from right here. So when I ended up coming out here for the postdoc, immediately I started exploring our backyard, the Santa Cruz Mountains. And very quickly, I found affinity groups. I found tasting groups, people who were super passionate about the history here and kind of helped me navigate because the Santa Cruz Mountains is a big place, lots of wines. And you know, some of the biggest gifts are the people who along the way taught me about the Santa Cruz Mountains. And then my science mind made me ask questions again and again. What is this place? What's here? Why are these wines so good? You know, there's touch points. I tried an 80s Ridge Chardonnay soon after I moved here, and it just blew me away. It was like lemon meringue pie with toasted hazelnuts, and it was ageable. And I had learned that ageable wines really are one of the marks of greatness in wine. So there's many touch points, but very generous people in tasting groups opening up very old bottles, 50s Hallcrest.
Oh my gosh, aren't you lucky?
Yeah, 20s La Cuesta. You know, wow. you taste some of these wines and then people are telling you, we'll try the great wines of the world, they're ageable. You can try wines from the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And then I would do that for the Santa Cruz Mountains every once in a while as well. And I was like, this must be a great wine region. These wines are amazing. The history is deep. There's so many firsts here. Innovation was here from the start. This is kind of ground zero for fine wine in California.
Right.
And my science brain just went off. And I started asking questions, fell down the rabbit hole. And then your hobby builds into a lifestyle. And then all of a sudden you ask the question, is this something I can actually do?
Well, that's a really big question, because doing it means changing from a, you know, a regular paycheck, I know what my career path is, to your, you know, kind of your own pioneer and your own story of winemaking and being a vintner. So it's a courageous thing to do. And you do it when you love it enough, you can't imagine doing anything else, I guess. Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, and your family supports you.
I have the greatest wife. My wife, Risha, also loves wine. In fact, I met her on a rooftop in San Francisco at a wine tasting.
So, oh, how romantic.
And this theme of all pathways that comes to wine, we met over wine tasting that she was hosting. And we have traveled to taste wine and explore wine. And she's an equal partner in this, for sure, supporting me. But she also does a lot of the activities for the winery. She does a lot of the compliance and finance, and she's just absolutely pivotal to the winery. But also, she'll just taste with me and she'll listen to me. I'm very critical, and she'll always bring me back down to earth and say, let me know, you know, what is good. And, you know, sometimes I'm overly critical of my own wines, and she says, look, this is delicious. Isn't that what matters first? Isn't that what matters first? And that's great. It's very easy as winemakers to get lost in details.
That's great to have somebody who can balance you that way.
Exactly. So, you know, the hobby turning into the profession was interesting. I started making wine with some of these people in my tasting groups who knew a lot about the Santa Cruz Mountains. And all of a sudden you find yourself making delicious wines and getting your hands dirty and getting into the vineyard and picking. And it's exciting and wonderful. And then I asked the question, well, can you get a degree in this, you know, without going back to school? I already had a science background. So I ended up getting a Davis certificate degree in the background.
Oh,
UC Davis.
Okay.
And then I really took a dive. I jumped in and said, well, why don't I work a harvest? And I was really inspired by Reese Vineyards up on the skyline here in the Santa Cruz Mountains.
And I should say for everybody listening that we are sitting here with Rob in Saratoga, which is not too far from Reese, one of the premier wineries in the region. I mean, They're all so good, but they all have a distinct personality too. But just wanted to kind of place where we are and what we're talking about.
Absolutely. We're so close to Reese. And actually, it's kind of very fitting being in the Ridge Room, because I was so inspired by Ridge early on. I still am. I mean, I'm one of those guys who would hang out at the Ridge, you know, assemblage parties or the pickup parties, mm-hmm. and we'd be drinking all the old bottles. Sure. And I'd be learning and saying, what is this? This is amazing. So Ridge has always been an inspiration.
Yeah. And what Rob's referring to is we are at the offices of Ridge Vineyards, not at the winery itself, but here in downtown Saratoga, one of the towns along the Santa Cruz Mountains. And they have been very generous in inviting us to come and do our podcast taping here so we could be on location with Rob.
It's a great place to be. So yes, I did a harvest at Reese. And then after working at such an amazing winery with so many resources and such incredible vineyards, I really looked back to the history in the old and said, where can I work where it's just all about the place? And so I ended up doing a harvest in 17 at Mount Eden. And Mount Eden is definitely you know, a place with history, and those wines are all about the place. There's just such a common thread. If you taste a Mount Eden from any vintage and work with the great Jeffrey Patterson there. And that was an amazing vintage to work. And soon after, you know, all of this is inspired by people. Sandar and Him is a story about people and place. In fact, the label, as you alluded to, is my Norwegian ancestors. When we were starting to name the winery in 18, which is a hard thing to do sometimes. Bergstrom is a winery in the Willamette that's very well known, and that's my last name. But I was doing my ancestry while I was trying to name the winery, and I realized that Bergstrom was assumed and that my great-grandfather actually wasn't a Bergstrom. He came from Hem Farm in Norway, and he changed his name soon after coming to America, and we don't know why. I should have asked this question 40 years ago when the right people couldn't answer it. So after doing ancestry and going through social media and connecting to some third cousins near Oslo, my family and I went to Norway for the summer, and we met the Hems of the Sandar region of Norway. And they lived on a family farm, agricultural origins. They drove me around the family farm. It was amazing. It was like the stories you hear where you're 1% related to someone, but you get off the train and everybody's there.
Oh, that's so great.
Just really, really special moment. And kind of that confluence of people and place is an important theme. And I find that in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and falling into winemaking was the same. There's people in my tasting groups, there's mentors. And then the thing that really pushed us over was this relationship with growers. Over time, you've been making wine, you build relationships, and then all of a sudden you start talking to growers, and the growers build trust in you. And in 2018, the spring of 2018, we started asking a few growers, well, if we were interested in making wine, do you think we could get some grapes? And that's like a really big thing. We don't own an estate winery. We are excited about all these different sites and wanted to explore the Santa Cruz Mountains. So we started talking to growers. We had relationships via winemaking friends and vineyard managers and tasting group friends. And, you know, right away, three or four vineyards we loved and were super excited about, we realized we could get the fruit. And my wife and I kind of looked at each other and she's like, go for it. This is what you want to do. So,
which vineyards were they?
So one of the early ones was Bates Ranch, Charlie Bates, the current owner of Bates Ranch, and his family, have had this in their family for generations. They have Cabernet, Cab Franc, and Grenache on site. I have a tasting group called Vinum Obscurum, and I had a bunch of local people over, and we did a retrospective with about 40 bottles of Bates Ranch going back to the maybe 1970.
Wow.
It was a snowball tasting. I invited a few people that I knew, and then the Algrens got invited, and then Charlie Bates came in, and then Prudy Fox was there, and people who had worked at Santa Cruz Mountain Vineyards were there. And all of a sudden, it was almost like a historic tasting.
I want to be part of your tasting
group.
That
sounds so cool. I mean, not Obscurum anymore. That was kind of...
No, that was... And that really is exactly what can happen in the Santa Cruz Mountains. The community is small. People reach out. People are saying, hey, let's learn about Bates Ranch. Let's mm-hmm. taste these old vintages. And people all had bottles from all these wineries that, you know, some of them only made wine for a few years that I had never heard of. And so all of a sudden we're tasting all these amazing wines. This is back when Dex Algren was still alive. He passed away a few years ago after, but it was just a huge privilege to have him and Val there. To taste through their wines.
Algren's one of the wineries in the region.
Yes, and they were one of the first people to make Bates Ranch Cabernet. So it was a huge honor to have them there. But this is an example of how we made the connection through a network. And all of a sudden, Charlie Bates is sitting in my living room. And then when it came time, you know, I talked with Prudy Fox, the vineyard manager, talked with Charlie Bates, and all of a sudden we get fruit from a vineyard we really admire and are excited to work with.
That's so interesting. I've always wondered how it worked because in theory, growers have their vines all booked up. So do you have to wait for someone to say, yeah, I'm not going to buy the Bates this year? Or do you have to, is it go to the highest bidder? And is it always, are you locked in? Do you know you're going to get the grapes? Or how gambly is it?
We would need a lot of glasses of wine for me to tell you the story of how I got every parcel of grapes.
You probably don't want to give away your secrets.
Yes. No, I mean, you don't have to reveal anything.
But absolutely, it's just getting to know people, uh-huh. building relationships, and people knowing really that you care, that you're trying to bring out the best expression of the vineyard, mm-hmm. that you're going to do justice to the vineyard. I think over time, growers start sorting those people out and figuring it out. Sometimes it's also, there is some, they raise the price until people say uncle and mm-hmm. other people jump in. And, you know, it's not necessarily wrong for them to do it because nobody's making a ton of money in the industry, especially the growers. It's been perilous with, you know, there's no normal vintage anymore. We have fire, we have heat waves, we have drought. And growers really deserve a lot of credit. And so building relationships with them has been a joy. Not only that, I've become a grower. So now we have a 50-year-old Chardonnay vineyard, a 48-year-old vineyard. it's the same age as me. So I'm already thinking of it as 50. I'm right on the precipice. But over near in Ben Lomond, I farm. I get on the tractor. I'm doing most things. I do bring in crews for some help. I have a vineyard consultant, but I spend hundreds of hours every year in the vineyard. You know, it's changed the way that I look at my growers and talk with my growers. I respect them greatly. It's challenging. It's amazingly rewarding. And it's been one of the great joys of doing this. Is if you would have asked me when I fell down this rabbit hole whether I'd be farming, I would have said it sounds like a good dream, but here we are doing it. We don't own the vineyard. We may own vineyards in the future just because it's been so rewarding. But
cool.
Yeah, it's been a really fun aspect. So our growers have been super important and kind of seminal in us moving this forward. And we're trying to tell us a greater story about the Santa Cruz Mountains. And I feel like we're very nimble. We're able to pull from vineyards all over the region and ask questions and make delicious wines that kind of paint a mosaic. And the growers are kind of our key partner.
Love it. So tell us about the grower behind this Chardonnay that you brought for us to taste.
So this is got it in our glass right now. It's beautiful.
This is the 2020 Brizzoni Vineyard Chardonnay. Berna Brizzoni comes from a family that has owned many vineyards in the Santa Cruz Mountains. This one is near Scotts Valley, just about 3 miles up the road from Santa Cruz. What that means is we get really cool nights and cool mornings. We get fog. This vineyard is alluvial, so it's down in a little valley, but the material washing down is from marine terraces that surround it. So, you know, in these kind of sandy, loamy soils, you can sometimes find fossils in this region. This wine, I feel like before I made the wine, I had never tasted a wine from the site. And at the last minute, I trusted a good friend who said, look, people are not necessarily putting the vineyard on this Chardonnay. Go make the Chardonnay and put the vineyard on it. This is going to be a great site. And we did. And, you know, if you imagine a place like Chablis with a very big perspective, this wine has a perspective.
And you were saying there's some things like oyster wines, but you have a description for this one.
Yes. I mean, when I think of Chablis, I think of iodine and salt and lime and mouth shaping, mouth feeling. People like to say minerality, but I always talk about the mouth feel of that. It's like green apple and maybe lime pith. And, really shapes our mouth and makes our mouth water and makes us want something like an oyster. And I think this is definitely.
It's nice and crisp. I love it. It's.
I would love to have some chilled raw oysters right now.
And I don't know. I'm not a scholar of this stuff, so I'm not getting. But so correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not getting any kind of heavy oak influence here.
No, and you know, oak is something I've thought quite a bit about, and my mentors have, you know, I've learned from all of them. This is 1/4 new oak, but we use very lightly toasted oak, long light toast from Demi on this wine. We actually go to Meursault in France, and we work with their barrel maker to help us select forest, how long the staves are aged, toast levels. So we learn by tasting in other people's cellars. We learn from our barrel maker, and we actually get some barrels that aren't off the shelf here for a few of our wines. So, you know, when I worked at Reese, it was interesting. They always tried to use the same oak treatment for every wine so they could understand the difference in sites. But I diverged a little bit from that, and I really like to match the character of the oak a little bit to the site. You know, when you have something this kind of racy and salty, I feel like it needs a certain kind of oak, maybe something that brings a little bit of structure, but doesn't have too much spice, too much vanilla, too much toast. And so I didn't want to put toast on top of this great kind of mouthwatering wine. And so I did try to use a subtle oak.
Well, you know, this is just the polar opposite of the typical California Chardonnay with the big fruit, the oak, a little bit of butter, a creaminess. This is just crisp and pure. It's really, like you said, it's zippy, zesty, racy.
Good. I'm glad you enjoy it.
Oh, very and, nice. Yeah.
You know, it's fun because the Santa Cruz Mountains has a lot of different expressions. And as we explore, we're finding different ones. Some of the wines are a little richer. Some bring us tropicality. This is our oyster wine. We have lobster wines. We have the richer wine from the warmer site that you want to drink on the back porch. But I really, really tend to like higher acid wines because they're great for food. And they wake you up and wake up your palate. And this is a great site.
Are higher acid wines often lower in alcohol, or?
Oftentimes they are. If mm-hmm. we pick a little bit earlier, mm-hmm. So acid levels go down in grapes as they ripen. And so there's kind of a something of an inverse relationship. If we let the fruit hang and we're going to get higher alcohol wines, we're going to lose some acid. So, but there is also a magic to the Santa Cruz Mountains and its acid. Santa Cruz Mountains, really one of the hallmarks is great acid, great structure. And along with it comes a really great freshness, mouthfeel, and ageability that we see across the wines, even the riper wines that we make. When I say riper, for us, that's like 13% mm-hmm. alcohol, which on the Pantheon is pretty low. We still see great acid, and we're able to pick at low acids, half ripeness, and great acidity. It's one of the great gifts of the Santa Cruz Mountains.
I love that. A gift from the region. That's fantastic. But I also love the way you describe this, an oyster wine, a lobster wine. That, for me, makes it easier to relate to. And I think for many people who are intimidated about food wine pairing and the right thing with the right wine, I mean, that just makes it so simple and easy.
Thanks. Yeah, I find that, you know, also because I'm from food first, and I think in food flavors, my wife will tell you that I have nearly a photographic food memory. I can remember what we had on all our dates.
Really? First dates.
I remember flavor profiles. I describe wine a lot like food. You know, there's a whole lexicon for people in wine, and I do use some of that, but I always find it's there's a great commonality if we talk about it like a food.
Yes.
And how we want to pair it, but also what baking spices do we get from oak, or what citrus or stone fruit do I get when I taste it? What flower do I smell? What kind of barely ripe apple does this wine make my mouth feel like? The feeling of a wine, when we talk about food, it's a great, great thing. I think Americans don't always know how to talk. You know, we don't talk a lot about how something makes our mouth feel. And wine is so great because it brings us to that. We start doing that. We just start talking about mouth feel. But I think a very simple thing is, I think most people actually do know. People know that a green apple, a Granny Smith apple, gives you this feeling in the back of your tongue. And it's so useful when we're talking about wines to say, hey, this is shaping my mouth like a Granny Smith apple. People right away will say, I want that wine. Or
I get it.
Maybe yeah. you have something a little bit richer.
Or, right, right.
Yeah, rounder. So I think it's very, very useful to talk about food.
I love that. And I think that's so great, your background and your family's, the Chinese restaurant background. That's so fun. How much time was that in Davis as well?
That was in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Oh,
so
my goodness.
I toured the country a bit. My dad was a UC Davis professor, but then we moved to the Midwest. And my mom's roots, kind of them coming to America, started in Fargo and then ended up in Minneapolis. And so they have a Chinese restaurant. They had a family Chinese restaurant for decades in Minneapolis, but it was where we gathered for family gatherings. Standing by the wok in the kitchen is just watching my grandfather throw dozens of things into the wok measuring with a big ladle was just blew my mind, right? It's flavors, building complexity, made me think a lot. How is he doing that? How does he know how much to put? He's just using a big ladle and there's 30 things in front of him. So, you know, thinking about wine and delighting in wine and discovering who you are and your connection to your ancestry through wine is really, really fascinating, and it's fun.
Yeah.
And you know, as we continue to make wines, I always try to be thoughtful about the wine and think about how does it make me feel, what emotions does it bring up. I was really lucky enough to do a Zoom tasting with a group of psychologists. And it was amazing. Usually in a tasting, a lot of the kind of people who've been in wine for a long time are throwing out specific words like, I get this, I get lime, it's buttery, it does this. And the psychologists were just talking about how it made them feel. And I thought that was amazing. It was so refreshing.
Yeah.
Because sometimes we tear apart these wines, but sometimes I just want to hear it's delicious. Mm-hmm. And this reminds me of this time. Mm-hmm. Or this wine makes me happy. Or this wine makes me want to just sit down and think, you know.
Or get up and dance.
Yeah. I hope some people say that about my wines.
Hey, I wanted to, do you have a favorite Chinese dish having grown up in the restaurant?
Oh, you know, yes. Kind of my favorite banquety dish that my grandfather did was a black bean lobster.
Ooh, that sounds good.
It's harder and harder to get lobsters now. You know, some of my favorite dishes also were the home dishes. You have something maybe called Mapo Tofu, which is a really hard wine pairing, by the way. It's chili oil and kind of numbing spices, so it kind of calls for a big red, or we can just cheat and use sparkling wine. But also things, I'm fascinated by dishes that evolved in America that only exist in America. I've been always obsessed with egg foo young and all these things, because watching my grandfather make these foods and tell me that they didn't exist where he came from was fascinating to me. And to me, it's the genesis of something new and maybe even great. Sometimes people discount them, but sure. I really love all these kind of interesting dishes.
You know about that book? I think it's called The Fortune Cookie Chronicles.
I have it. And right up my alley. It's exactly talking about kind of what it means to like reinvent food in America. And I think a lot about that. And you know, we think about that a lot in wine. You know, we get inspiration from old world wines. But we don't pretend to think that we're going to make Burgundy in California.
Well, some people do.
Some people do. But we're inspired by the structure, by the techniques, by the people. Sometimes just by the crazy personalities. We're just inspired by those people. And we learn a lot from them. And sure, I travel to different regions that make these wines, including Burgundy, and take a lot of inspiration from them. But I use them as hallmarks and benchmarks, but I still come back to California and I'm always thinking about what is new about this wine and, you know, what is California wine? And I think that's fun.
Absolutely. And, I think having that background really gives you a great lens, as you like to say, on just the wine itself and bringing out these characteristics that this Chardonnay is a great example of. You get that saltiness in the note when you smell it. You get it when you certainly taste it. And I think that's really fascinating.
It is. It is. It makes you think about a lot about why is this site like this. It's also fascinating, why does it remind me of Chablis? Why do sommeliers call that Chablis blind? I think it's a little bit more tropical. But it has a lot of the kind of things that remind us of something else. And I think, again, back to the feeling, giving us a feeling of something that we like when we drink a wine is amazing. And yes.
Do you and Risha always agree on styles of wine and stuff? Do you guys have similar palates, or do you come at it from different perspectives? Does she like stuff that you don't and vice versa?
So we do agree a lot on wine. And sometimes we diverge. We both like high acid wines. We both like earlier picked wines. She's more forgiving of a wider type styles of wine. Sometimes I'll taste a wine and I'll say, oh, it's a little, alcohol's a little bit high and it's a little bit heavy for me. And she is better at just enjoying it, saying, but it's got beautiful fruit. I would call her a wine tasting optimist. She always finds the great things.
Oh, what a perfect person to refreshing. Be partnered with. My goodness. You need an optimist in your life. Oh, everyone does.
It is. And it's back kind of to that emotion thing. It's really refreshing to taste with people who just take a sip, maybe make a little sound of satisfaction and just be there, be with the wine. Because winemakers instead want to say the three things that they think the winemaker did and maybe what they might do differently and maybe something about the vintage. And it's really nice to have someone bring you back sitting next to you who just like, that's good.
Yes.
Those moments are important. That I think a lot of times that's what wine is, and we need to bring ourselves back to that.
It's so true. As a general just consumer of wine, I'm not a wine expert and would never pretend to be. I don't always have the vocabulary or the words at the ready that describe a wine in the way that a sommelier will describe it or a winemaker. For me, the words that come to mind are very basic and like yum, delicious, spicy, crispy, you know, nothing, nothing multisyllabic. And I've always felt a little, I've often felt a little embarrassed about that, but I like the spin you've put on this. I'm a wine optimist. I just want to enjoy it.
Absolutely. And I think there's something to enjoy in a lot of wines, and it's easy for us to get very focused on a lens, especially when you're a winemaker, and say, this is what I'm trying to achieve. But seeing that there's a lot of wines out there that a lot of people appreciate, and maybe finding how to appreciate them yourselves, there's always joy there.
So we've got a couple of your bottles in front of us, and I'm just looking at these gorgeous and very intricate labels. Tell us about them.
Yeah, that was a really important part about early part about launching our brand. You know, you try to come up with a name, which ended up being very satisfying for us with the Sandar and Hem name. And my wife and I really love different styles of art, and that's a place where we often agree as well, which is good, because as we travel, we don't disagree that much over which piece we might pick up when we're traveling. But when I was thinking about the winery, I wanted something to evoke a place, right? I really like this idea of what's here and how does a site translate to some kind of emotion and flavor. And so we thought a lot about what we could do, and I kept coming back to, we need to somehow classify a place or tell a story of a place. And I always love this notion of, in organically farmed vineyards or vineyards with minimal inputs, we have a lot of native plants. And the native plants oftentimes are helping to flavor the wine. We can see sometimes at Bates Ranch, we always have like wild sage and a few other natives there that always bring maybe a little herbal component to the wine we're drinking right now. And we see that also in the Cab. And so I always said, what are these natives in the Santa Cruz Mountains? And wouldn't it be great to have a label that shows a lot of the native plants that are growing in our vineyards? And so then when I came up with that concept, I found these plates from a woman from the 1800s who had done botanicals of all the Santa Cruz Mountains, but she was never really well known, maybe because of she was a female in the 1800s, but the plates were amazing. I was in a library and I looked at this book and said, this is incredible. So I thought about how can I bring that to the future? And I found, just looking for people doing art in the Santa Cruz Mountains, I found Lily Arnold in Felton, a local artist, a woodcut. She does woodcuts, but she also can work digitally. And she's doing amazing botanical woodcuts in beautiful colors. So I reached out to her. I don't think she usually does this kind of art. I brought her. I was a little sneaky and brought her to the vineyard when all the native flowers were exploding in the spring. And told her a little bit about what we're doing, how we're celebrating the Santa Cruz Mountains in this place. And amazingly, she agreed to work with us. And so now we have this label. This label is kind of a microcosm of flowers and native plants that we find in the Santa Cruz Mountains. We were inspired by what she created, and now that's our label.
That's fantastic. And each label is a different color. And how did you decide what color goes with what wine?
Yeah, so the multicolor label we use across Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, and then we have just kind of on the whim inspiration used different colors. We've used a label for a Santa Cruz Mountains AVA Chardonnay. We've used red for our Cabernet. We've used blue, and a lot of it is more like a color palette. We're looking at a rosé wine that's, you know, pink, and then a light blue is just feels so good next to it. So a lot of it sometimes is a kind of a little bit of artistic embellishment.
And an emotion.
It is. Yeah? It is.
So we've got this rosé now in our glasses. Tell us about this.
Yeah. So, you know, I was saying some of the early vineyards that we brought on, Bates Ranch was important. This is from Bates Ranch, which is in the very south end of the Santa Cruz Mountains in a warmer site. So we're just inland from Watsonville and between Gilroy and Watsonville near Mount Madonna, another large mountain of note in the Santa Cruz Mountains. Well, we first agreed to get a Cabernet Sauvignon from the site with Charlie Bates and Prudy Fox. And my first vintage, I was realizing that we really wanted to have some wines that were simple and approachable and fun. And so as I told you earlier, we were coming off the mountain in our first vintage, and I let Prudy Fox know, the vineyard manager, know that I was interested in maybe having some other wines that were fun and maybe affordable. And she knocked on my window and said, hey, we have this Grenache parcel down the road. And so we ended up going down there and tasting together. And when I tasted it, it tasted like peaches and plums and had great, kind of a great refreshing flavor. And I was inspired. And that, so that we came back a few days later and we picked Grenache, not for red wine, but for rosé. And this, ever since then, we've had this rosé program in our portfolio, and it's a fun one. It's, you can be, it can be a serious wine because it's mineral and it has herbal components. But it's also one that you can just drink and enjoy. So this is like one of those fun wines that, you know, I really enjoy.
It's great.
Thank you.
It's really good. Sometimes for me, rosé kind of lean sweet, and I don't care for that. What I love about this is I can taste the great fruit in it, but it's so restrained. It's got good acid, and it's just, I really like it.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, of course, we're inspired by the Provençal style of rosé, and we didn't know what this was going to be in the first year. We just let it go dry. And it reminded me a lot of a Provençal rosé, and I was delighted at that. And so, yeah, we try to, we press very lightly. We try to get a very pure expression from this. And every year it brings really satisfying, again, like peach and plum spectrum fruit. But it also has great acid, a little bit of mineral. And again, that kind of native, I think it's from the native plants around it, a little bit of herbal component that I think it makes it fascinating.
What I've noticed between the two wines we've tried, your Chardonnay and this rosé, they both have these amazing aromas. I just love smelling each one of them. And it's a very layered aroma that you get, kind of like a perfume as it's developing on your skin.
Nice. I like that. Yeah, we try our very best to highlight the site and also bring out aromatics. And, you know, winemakers tend to say, I just try to do the minimal inputs and let the vineyard be. We do that, but along the way, there's hundreds of little details. And little details not necessarily secrets. Yeah. So you can ask our interns this year. They'll say, I tell them all. Mm-hmm. But I feel like there's a lot of ways to get freshness in these wines, whether it's the way that you bring in the grapes, your pick decision, of course, is huge, but also the way that you're pressing your lees work, you know, whether you might lightly fine the wine. All these decisions help us bring clarity and kind of exuberance to the wine. So we're always making little tiny decisions. How long should we age? You know, for Chardonnays, we do extended aging on lees, which we think gives us something special. And so we're always making all these little decisions, trying to bring out the best, but also bring out aromatics and freshness and transparency.
In your journey of winemaking, and I guess growing now too, because you're a farmer as well, have you ever really blown it? Like had like, oh man, I made a bad call on this one.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely picked wines earlier than I thought I would. You know, the weather is always,
I know, it's crazy. So changeable.
I mean, this vintage was classic. You know, we had 100 plus degrees for a week. And so sometimes it was, you can have a pick crew today or you can have it in a week. Which do you want? And there is a lot of that this year. So sometimes we bring in wines at lower alcohol than we want. Sometimes in the cellar, I made decisions to not keep heavy lees, and then I wish I kept the lees around. You know, there's lots of things, decisions that we make. I've never thrown a wine away yet.
That's a good sign.
But, you know, it's inevitable. If you're a winemaker, there's going to be something that happens, not always under your control, maybe sometimes under your control, you make a decision that you don't like. And, you know, sometimes that becomes a component to your AVA wine and you make a delicious, like Santa Cruz Mountain wine instead of a vineyard designate. You know, you can also sell wine, but I haven't had to do that yet. So I'm sure it'll happen. I expect it to happen, but we've been lucky so far. You know, the smoke year 2020, where we had a lot of fires, excepted where we did just, we have some wines that are in drum now, but we just simply won't bottle them. They won't be bottled. That was 100% beyond our control. That was an example of maybe not the decision I made. I could have left it hanging and not picked it and saved a lot of money. But we were learning. We were all learning. We were all figuring it out. And those are all the only wines that we haven't brought to market.
When we were talking before we started the podcast, you were talking about the range of fruit and the weather and the conditions from the north to the south of the Appalachian. And something like, what is it? Snails or something all the way to rattlesnakes. Can you tell our listeners about that?
The Santa Cruz Mountains is a really big region, 100 miles north to south, and maybe to the horror of old world wine regions. We grow Cab next to Chardonnay sometimes. We have warm weather grapes. We have Rhone varieties. We have a lot of diverse varieties and a lot of expressions, even within a given variety. And, you know, in 20 minutes, you can drive from a site that's scrub chaparral with rattlesnakes. And then all of a sudden, you can be in a redwood forest that's drippy and cold and wet. We can change 30 degrees with 20 minutes of driving. These are all in the same viticultural area.
And you got banana slugs.
And banana slugs, yeah. So it's amazing how fast, the diversity of microclimates that we have. But it's also one of the things that makes Santa Cruz Mountains great. Really allows us to make a lot of really interesting wines and always find that spot that pushes the variety just right, pushes it to its edge so we can make a compelling wine. You know, late at night when winemakers talk, we talk a little bit about, maybe sometimes over beer, we talk about what the sub-appellations might look like and we nerd out. But a funner way to explore it is just to make wines. For us, you know, we make 11, 12 Chardonnays over the last several years from very different sites that we all think are distinctive in some ways. And through a lot of kind of delicious, different expressions of wines, we explore the region and we see that the Santa Cruz Mountains is very multidimensional, but makes really delicious wine.
It sure does. Hey, before we get into our next wine, I wanted to ask you about the other really key and I guess the most important thing in your life. And you mentioned it earlier, your three children.
I have three children. That's Bryce, Evan, and Tessa, and they're age 9, 10, and 12.
And tell me about some of the stuff you guys enjoy doing together.
We love doing outdoor activities. We like hiking and we like fishing and rock hounding. We do a lot, we love exploring the world and outdoors. We do a lot of backcountry activities. In fact, at the end of harvest every year, and maybe in a week here, I'm going to go into the Mojave with my kids and we're going to go see old forts and see Spanish mines and see wildlife and really be way out there and just immerse ourselves. We love that.
And you mentioned something that I think is like the coolest dad thing ever, sleep in a cave.
Oh, yeah. So near Barstow, there's a lot of incredible things in the backcountry. This is near Mojave, the Mojave Road, not too far from Joshua Tree. Exploring, we found whole valleys full of petroglyphs. We found a cave, a miner's cave, that as he was mining opals, he hollowed out a whole hill of stone. And so we go there and the kids like to sleep in this cave. And I remember the first time we went about a year and a half ago, the kids went back to school and told their teacher that they were sleeping in a cave. And the teacher, I don't know if the teacher believed it because that's kind of a big claim from a kid, right? But absolutely, we love doing that. I think it awakens their senses. It makes mm-hmm. them ask questions. Who were these people? What was that time? It's also just fun to sleep in a cave.
And rejuvenating for you as well. But what do the kids think about dad and his winemaking? And are they interested?
Absolutely. And they're piecing it together. A great example is at the beginning of the pandemic, we spent hundreds of hours together in the Leboeuf vineyard, the one that we farm. It's a beautiful parcel. It's over 10 acres surrounded by Wilder Ranch. So it's quiet. It's surrounded by redwoods. It's a pastoral site. And there's redwood rings and it's a delightful place. And when school wasn't in and they hadn't figured out distance learning, it was a place that the family just spent together. We literally lived in a vineyard 4 to 6 hours a day. I was doing canopy management. I was, hand hoeing vines. I was doing all kinds of things. And the kids would come in and do it for a little while. And then they'd go play. But I think they saw farming. They saw the seasons. They saw all the inputs to make something as simple, quote unquote, as a grape. And I think that was big for them. Really to see, to live on there in a place where we're farming, because in modern day, when we're in cities, we don't always get to see all those processes. So we'll see. No one said I want to make wine like you, Dad, yet. But, you know, they're interested. They love smelling wine. They are fascinated at whenever I do bring in grape samples. For this year, we had 13 sites. I bring in grape samples, and I'm constantly tasting and looking at sugars and acids. They love doing the grape juice tasting afterwards. So they're interested in it. They're engaged. But, you know, I can't say that I know that we have the next winemaker in the family.
They've got time. They have lots of time.
Exactly. They'll go out and discover the world, and maybe they'll have the same experience going down the rabbit hole with wine that you had.
I hope so.
So our last wine today is a barrel sample you brought us. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we didn't do the winery today, so I thought I was in the winery late last night, and I was like, why don't I bring some Pinot? This would be fun.
Thank you.
My pleasure. So we have a new site out near the beach, San Gregorio. So this is the very edge of the Santa Cruz Mountains. Santa Cruz Mountains is interesting because the boundaries are set by altitude. So when we get right to the edge, that 400-foot mark above the Pacific Ocean, there's a series of vineyards out there, kind of I call the frontier, where people are really pushing the edge of grapes. And this is from one of those sites. This is called the Deerhart Vineyard. It was planted by someone who's really passionate about Pinot Noir and Burgundy. They really brought in great vineyard consultants, great vine material. It's kind of some of the lesser planted varieties, including the Swiss clone to a 943 from Dijon clone. Just a lot of interesting clones that plant material that we don't necessarily see very often and make compelling wine, explosive aromatics. This here is interesting because it's from a single barrel of 100% whole cluster. That means we never destemmed it. We never crushed it. It went into the fermenter as whole clusters the way they came out of the vineyard. And when we do that, we get a special kind of aromatic. We get purple flowers. We get a velvety mouthfeel on the back of our tongue. We get, sometimes it reminds me of grape bubblegum. All the in the best way. You know, if you had Beaujolais Nouveau, you know, kind of the exuberance of that. Mm-hmm. This is a little bit of that in this. I thought it would be fun because this is 943 and 667 clone. The 943 clone isn't very widely planted in California because there's no business case. It's low yielding. But this is fun. It's not in bottle yet. But I thought it'd be really fun because this is kind of pushing all the edges. We're out by the beach. We're on the edge of the AVA. It's a cool new clone. It's the fruiting wire is at 18 inches. In other words, the fruit is just off the ground. Mm-hmm. This is something they do in Burgundy in cold places to bring heat to the fruit to get it ripe. So the grower has done really amazing things to try to create a really unique expression of Pinot Noir. And it's been a joy to work with this. Nathan Candler, the winemaker from Fogarty, is also working with this. It was too much fruit for me to take early on, so we're splitting this parcel.
This is so good.
When we release this in spring, you can look out for the Fogarty version mm-hmm. and the Sandar and Hem version. Nice. And it'll be fun. We try not to talk too much about what we do so that we can have two different wines.
Oh,
the grower's
so
delighted at that.
Yeah.
But this is a fun one. The final wine probably won't be 100% whole cluster, but it's really fun to taste some of the things we can do as a winemaker to bring that aromatic exuberance to a wine.
And it's spicy.
Spicy, yeah. Those stems can bring an earth spice.
I love it. This is like a cowabunga for me. You got that beach
nice.
Thing?
I love it.
Yeah.
And how do you find sites like that?
Yeah. You know, I'm always on the prowl for new hikes and for new vineyards. And sometimes they overlap. You know, the Santa Cruz Mountains has all these nooks and crannies and different geologies and different microclimates. And when I'm out driving or riding a bike, if I see a vineyard, I say, what is that? And I have some friends who just have these encyclopedic knowledges of old vineyards and new. You know, there's older folks who've been around, like Michael Martella, and, you know, over at Catherine Kennedy, Catherine Kennedy's son, Marty Mathis. These people are encyclopedias, and you can just literally point to a vineyard on a hill and they'll just know who's made it, when it was planted. But sometimes we find these newer sites and we say, who's making that? What is that? And so sometimes I'll even leave a note in a mailbox.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's a new vineyard even further out towards the beach. It just popped up. And
people will call you. They don't think it's somebody crazy.
So I go out to the beach with my kids every few weeks, maybe not during harvest, but it'll start again. And I'm very tempted to drop a postcard in their mailbox and say, why did you plant here? That's amazing. And mm-hmm. what is it? And can I have some?
Sure. Nothing ventured, yeah. Nothing gained.
Yeah. So we're always on the lookout. We also have a lot of friends who know kind of our mission to discover new places. I'm enthralled by the bringing back old vineyards that are historic, but also these newly appointed vineyards that are kind of pushing the edge. You know, with, you know, the climate changing a bit, and also just continuing to explore the AVA, I think it's really interesting, you know, some of these wines from Pescadero, from San Gregorio, way out on the edge, really pushing, in this case, Pinot Noir to the edge. I think you can make some fascinating wines, and I'm excited about this site. You know, we also work with Mendigo Ridge, which is near La Honda, just another mile inland and a couple more miles inland. And both these sites are just fantastic, but they couldn't be more different. And we want to celebrate those differences and see what they are.
Well, it's so exciting. And Rob Bergstrom, you are doing some great things with wine. Your wines, all three, have been delicious. And I just love your story. I love what you said earlier, that the philosophy of wine, like you I feel like today we got to hear some of your personal philosophy. And that was truly, it's been truly a pleasure getting to know you and what drives you and kind of what helps you craft what you're doing, you know?
Thank you. This has been fun. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
And getting to know you, really, now that I know you better, I get the sense of you and your wines too.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic.
So yeah, keep doing what you're doing. And thank you for sharing this time with us. We've really thoroughly enjoyed it, and continued success to you.
And how can people find your wines and follow you?
So the easiest way is to go to sandarandhem.com. And our wines are available for sale online. And we have a wine club, of course.
And Sandar is Sandar and Hem.
H-E-M. Absolutely. That's a great way to connect with us. We're also at some local shops, but here in the Bay Area. But our website's a great place to connect with us. Join our newsletter. See what we're up to.
I want to know when these wines are going to be available in your homeland, like when the people of Sandar.
They are. I have a Norwegian distributor.
Do so you? Oh, terrific.
They're on the ocean. Nowadays, it can take up to a year for something to get somewhere. But we have a couple pallets sailing to Norway right now.
Oh, that's wonderful.
How exciting.
Well, Rob, thank you again. Cheers to you, and sip, sip, hooray.
Cheers. Thank
Cheers.
You.
Cheers.
Well, that's going to do it for our podcast today. Thank you for listening to Sip, Sip, Hooray. We hope if you enjoyed the show that you'll share it with your friends, your family, spread the word about the Sip, Sip, Hooray podcast.
And you can do that by, one, going to our website, sipsiphoraypodcast.com. There you'll see all the different podcast platforms we are on. And go to your favorite one and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode when it drops. And be sure to follow us on social media. We are at sipsiphoraypodcast on Instagram and Facebook, and sipsiphoray, the number one, on Twitter. Be sure to tag us with any photos, if you've tried any of these wines or been to the wineries, we'd love to hear from you.
That's right. We want you in the Sip Sip Hooray family, so do stay in touch with us. And that's going to do it for us, Mary. It's time to go out and eat, drink, and be merry.
Absolutely. We're going to pop the cork and raise a glass.
Cheers to you, Mary Orland.
Cheers to you, Mary Babbitt. Sip Sip Hooray.
Sip Sip Hooray.